Well, it's almost winter in Wisconsin officially, and for many birds, that means it's time to head south. A lot of them have already headed south, and Bill Volkert's going to talk about that with us. Bill, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for well over 40 years. And he's been answering our birding questions on the show for a long time as well, so it's great to have him back. Fall's a pretty active time for birds. We'll take a look at what's going on around the state and, of course, take your questions and comments. Maybe you've seen an unusual bird recently. We'd certainly love to hear about that. What signs of fall migration are you looking at right now? Join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post a question. And or if you got a bird photo, we'd always love to see those. Put those up on our Facebook page. We always love to see those photos. And Bill Volkert, welcome back.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much.
Good to have you back. What birds have you been seeing recently?
Well, the last 2 days, I've had tundra swans flying overhead, and that's always one of our later migrants. And as people probably remember, we had a good cold front come through here on Monday evening. The north-northwest winds were blowing. And this morning I woke up with not only frost, but a little bit of ice. So for the water birds, that means that the access to food is just beginning to seal up a little bit in the shallows. And that's a good signal for these birds to depart. And with the cold front and the wind shifting, it also means they had a good tailwind. So they took advantage of that. And tundra swans are unusual because they don't have a normal north-south migration. They're more or less going across the entire continent, from some nesting at Hudson Bay, others all the way to the northern slope of Alaska. They'll end up at Chesapeake Bay. So
wow.
We're seeing a lot of them shooting here to the Mississippi River as a big resting area and staging site. Where I am in east-central Wisconsin, they're flying straight to the east, going over Lake Michigan, probably make a stop or two, and then finally end up on the East Coast.
Yeah, so it's great. You know, fall migration, for a lot of people, doesn't seem as dramatic as the spring migration.
Well, you're right. There is a real difference. In spring, the birds are singing in preparation for nesting, so they're much more vocal.
Yeah.
They're in their brilliant plumage. A lot of them now have faded their colors. And we also notice those birds after a long winter. When they first arrive, all of a sudden you get up in the morning and there's that first Baltimore Oriole or some other songbird that has arrived overnight. In fall migration, especially when I kind of go through and keep my data as to the presence of these birds, it's in retrospect that you realize the last one left. You look back a few days like, yeah, I guess I haven't seen them and there haven't been any sightings. It reminds me recently also of making mental notes of the fall color peak around here.
Yeah.
You never know how intense it's going to get. I always recognize just how peak the colors were 2 days later. It's like, okay, they're starting to fade. That's it. And so, yeah, it's one of those things where the birds are just slowly disappearing, and also others that are passing through here, especially for the earlier migrants, birds that are already on the move in August, September. Well, our leaves are still at full on the trees, and so if they're silent and in a drab plumage, they're also not as easily recognized.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Ryan in Onalaska has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. I love your shows, Larry.
Thank you.
Well, living in Onalaska, Wisconsin, I get to see a lot of wonderful birds near the Mississippi Valley, and thrush is one of my favorites, but he's always hard to find. They're always in the thickets and hard to find hiking, but recently we've had one the last week at our feeders in the backyard, and we have a heated garage, and the door I leave open when I take the dog for a walk. Three times now I've come back from the dog walk, and a thrush is in my garage. I don't know what he's doing. I've chased him out, so now we're shutting the door because I don't want to hurt the animal, but is there a reason he's going in the garage?
Apparently it's just a place for some shelter. That's all I could imagine. It's obviously not a place for any food, so probably when he's done feedings, whether he's looking for a thicket, which a lot of them are pretty barren right now, or here just a place to get out of the wind, the weather, and away from predators. Seems to work for them.
It's a nice garage.
Right, yeah, you must have a nice garage. So, yeah, I'm assuming it's just a hiding place for him.
Yeah.
Thanks. Is it also unusual to have the thrush at a feeder in the backyard?
Is he at the suet?
I have suet, I have peanut, and sunflower.
Yeah, thrushes are, of course, in that same family as robins, and invertebrates of all kinds will make up quite a bit of the food in summertime, but of course a lot of that now is dormant, and so they shift over to the berries. A couple weeks ago, I had a lot of thrushes that were hitting my dogwood shrubs, so they're really eating on that. Seed is not normally in their diet. They haven't got the beak to really crack those seeds and probably not an effective digestive system to be able to get the food energy out. So I'm assuming it's probably the suet that they're going for, which is pretty
available. Yeah, interestingly, my wife does not like to have the shells everywhere, so I feed all the peanuts and sunflowers out of the shell. So that might explain why you might like them.
Yeah, it may be something that you could take advantage of. It certainly would not be a normal food for them. They're not a seed eater as such.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Bob in Elkhorn, your turn next. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, listen, we were out by Evansville, Wisconsin, working, and we had a bird fly over her head, and it had a white head and a white tail. And it was probably big enough to be an eagle, but I thought it was a lot more brown than a black. So I'm just curious, like, is there another bird that could be out there that's, I thought it was a little bit too small to be an eagle, too, and I thought when they were juveniles, they didn't have the white head.
Well, you're right with the white head not developing until they're about 4 or 5 years old. There are some birds I've seen when they're coming into that first year of the adult plumage, it'll actually be sort of a dingy grayish white, not a real shiny white. And the body feathers, they're not black, but it is a real deep brown. And
okay,
as far as the size of a bird, especially when you're flying overhead, it's sometimes a little difficult to see whether you've got a large bird that's farther away or a smaller bird that's a little closer. You haven't got much to gauge it against. So one of the cues I usually go by is the rate of the wing beat. For most birds, the larger the bird, the slower the wing beat. So that gives you a little indication of the relative size of the bird. But as far as those field marks, it sounds like a bald eagle, and my guess would be it's probably a young bird that's just coming into the adult plumage.
Yeah, that'd be my guess. There's certainly no shortage of eagles in this part of the state.
Or anywhere in Wisconsin
right.
These days. Yeah, they have really made a tremendous comeback. And a bird that, years ago, you'd have to drive up north and maybe find sort of the right corner where they were nesting to get a sighting. Now it's nothing unusual anymore. It's great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Wayne in Arlington next. Wayne, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just got all the bird watchers that call in up by Darlington Prairie.
Arlington Prairie, did you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Up at the Goose Pond, there's hundreds of tundra swans on the pond, along with all the geese and ducks if they want to see those type of birds.
Oh, yeah. And that's a wonderful spot anyway, isn't it, Bill?
Well, yes. It's very accessible for a lot of people in southern Wisconsin. There's good bird watching right off the shoulder of the road. It's not that heavily traveled by the local traffic. And it's one of the few examples we have of a good prairie pothole lake. The Madison Audubon have done a tremendous job of restoring vast acreages of grassland with the two ponds around it. And they're also relatively shallow ponds. So you have vegetation, and of course, among that vegetation, the invertebrates as food throughout the entire stretch of it in most years. So like in most lakes, you have really the feeding area for ducks, geese, and swans would be just around the shoreline area. And that's what makes a lot of these wetlands and shallow lakes so productive, is that you've got sunlight and food production throughout the entire area, that water surface. And, yeah, they've been watching for some time now, and I've been getting the notifications about the various kinds of geese and white-fronted geese that have been sighted out there. So various goose species. So more than just the Canada. And now the swans are starting to show up. So,
yeah,
great spot. And, of course, I'll mingle in with an awful lot of ducks. They'll remain out there until a good ice cover starts to form.
Yeah. Wayne, thanks a lot for that report. I appreciate it very much. I want to give Katie and Franklin a chance to join in. Katie, hi to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I heard something on another show that I was listening to about removing feeders for a certain time during this migration so that you're not perhaps keeping birds in your yard that should be moving on and then putting them back out later in the winter, like, I don't know, maybe it would be mid-December or such. And I was just wondering if that's something to think about.
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, the other day when that was mentioned, I was working in my office at home, so I did not have the radio on, but my wife heard it, and she brought that to my attention. And I don't want to dispute other experts that Larry has on the show, and I'm certainly open to being corrected on this, but my understanding has always been that food certainly is indirectly the driver of migration. But the birds actually have to anticipate that loss of food. So, for example, you'll see large gatherings of swallows in early September, and they'll disappear within those first few weeks of September, where we don't really get a frost oftentimes until much later in the year. But if you're an insect eater, you better be gone before that food disappears. So for most birds, yes, food is the driver, but the stimulus or impetus for that is the shortening of the day length. And also for our backyard bird feeders, think about the suet and seed we're putting out. That's really, as we had mentioned earlier, for those seed-eating birds, which are our winter birds. That's why they stick around for winter. They can at least have access to seeds, where the insect eaters, they're gone. They're down in the tropics or down along the Gulf Coast now because their food has disappeared from Wisconsin. So I would really disagree with that, the necessity of taking down the bird feeders. I don't think that's going to keep the birds here. It's that day length that really drives the migration.
Them, yeah.
In the same way we hear that with hummingbirds, take down those hummingbird feeders because that's going to keep them from going. The fact is that those birds that do linger a little too long, that may be their only food source.
Yeah.
And so it might be important for some of those birds to actually keep it up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if there's a bird you really just want to have that bird gone, you can take away the seed and okay, that's all right. But I agree with you on this, Bill. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator. Always fun to have him on to talk birding. And he'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Hope you've been enjoying your fall bird watching this season. And I hope you have some questions for our guest, Bill Volkert. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for well over 40 years, and knows a whole lot about birds. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Maybe you've got something about bird feeders, a question. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page and open lines. We get you on pretty quickly. This whole question, Bill, thanks again for joining us. What's the best time typically to put out bird feeders?
Well, I think you could have feeders out year-round, quite honestly.
Yeah,
I do.
I do, too.
The problem, of course, in summertime is just competition with so much available food. So it's more of just a convenient thing for them. In fact, we've even found through studies that for the vast majority of birds, the bird food that we put out is really just like fast food. They don't really need it. It makes up a relatively small proportion of their actual diet, and they've always gotten by without it. What it really does is it brings the birds in closer so we can enjoy them. So that certainly is the benefit for us, and I believe that when we do have real severe winter storms and weather, it may be the real emergency stop to get them through when things are covered in fresh snow and ice and food is much harder to find. And, of course, when you've got the low temperatures and winds, they need that much more energy. But for most of the winter, it's just a convenience for the birds. But it certainly is wonderful. And when I do the Christmas bird counts, I, of course, will always try to take a look at the bird feeders where we concentrate some of the local birds. And it's always pleasing for me to see people who have a feeding station up and enjoy the birds around their backyard.
Yeah. And, you know, my cats would like it. I have indoor cats only. They never go outside, but the there's a perch there where they can sit and watch the birds come and go to the feeder.
Entertained, of course.
I have a friend who says, all I ever get are English sparrows, and I'm how do I get a broader variety of birds coming to my feeders?
Well, good question. My general rule of thumb is if you want a variety of birds, you need to offer a variety of food. So the different beak shapes of birds are specialized for different kinds of food. So the Niger or thistle seed is certainly attractive to the goldfinches, pine siskins, and red poles. So birds with the very small bills are used to taking those tiny seeds. The mixed seed offers a little bit of variety for some of the generalists, what spills on the ground. The juncos and mourning doves will be feeding on. The blue jays may come in. And then the larger seeds, such as the black oil sunflower seed, is a very nutritious seed. And that might be the trick to keep some of the house sparrows or English sparrows away. It's a bit of a large seed for them to handle. So try shifting over to that. If you have problems with starlings, there again, the larger seed, and do not offer the suet, which, of course, is attractive to woodpeckers, but the starlings may take that. The other important thing that I always emphasize is the fundamentals of habitat is food, water, shelter. All animals need that. And so we put out our bird baths and even heated bird baths. There's your source of water, which, of course, is less available when we have freezing temperatures. All this bird seed and other kinds of bird food is certainly attractive, but a lot of people don't tend to get them in some of these neighborhoods because of lack of shelter. It's your landscaping. They need to feel safe. And so having some thickets, some shrubs, or conifer trees nearby the feeding station is certainly important. The other thing that we need to also be careful of is we should reduce those window collisions. You mentioned before about keeping cats indoors. They are a really significant mortality factor for native birds, but also our windows. We've got a lot of houses with a lot of windows, and I'm sure everybody's had the experience of something crashing into it. It's just not natural for birds. They see the reflections of the trees behind them, or they may actually see from one window to another, thinking that it's a clear path. And so check with the website of the American Bird Conservancy, abc.org, and they've got a number of hints for some of the different things you can do with your windows to reduce that. Because after all, the last thing you want to do is attract all these birds into your backyard and then have something die from colliding with your window.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff in Slinger has something for us. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
And what's on your mind today?
In the backyard, there was a dead blue jay. And next to that was, like, hawk feathers. Just a whole bunch. It could have even been parts of a hawk, too, like a red-tailed. What happened?
Well, there's a good question. First of all, red-tailed hawk is not normally one of the birds of prey that goes after birds. They've got the large rounded wings and that square tail. That's for soaring, and they essentially drop down and pounce on their prey. So the rodents and small rabbits tend to make up most of their food. It's the Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned hawks, who have the short wings, the very long tail like a rudder, and they chase down their prey. They will take small mammals, but a variety of the songbirds are occasionally their food source. So I would be leaning more toward the possibility of something like a Cooper's hawk that may have been there. Now, normally, something like a blue jay, they can handle fairly well. Shouldn't be much of a problem for a larger Cooper's hawk. Whether there was a struggle there, that the bird had lost some feathers, say a smaller sharpshin may have gotten himself a little bit of a large food source, which may have led to some tussle there and the possible loss of some feathers. Perhaps that's it. I'm guessing a little bit.
Yeah, I can tell. Scott Craven told me a story about a buddy of his who is with the DNR who had a Cooper's hawk feeding in his backyard on something, and a sharpshin came in and grabbed at the Cooper's hawk.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, when food's available, anybody will probably join in and try their own chances. You know, and also mentioning Cooper's hawks, since they do feed on birds, this is another instance where I would recommend shutting down a bird feeding station. If you have a hawk that is using your bird feeders as his hunting site, it's a little unfair that we're kind of setting up these birds by luring them in and making them more easy targets, because normally birds are more scattered across the countryside. Here we concentrate them, and oftentimes a little bit more open area where they can fall prey. If anybody should experience that problem of a Cooper's hawk that is making himself a little bit at home and taking some of the songbirds, shut it down for a week or so. As his luck declines, he'll move on, and then you can start all over again.
Yeah. Jeff, thanks again. Appreciate it. Bill in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. I had a question for your guest. Looking for places to go this coming weekend to see some of the migrating birds that are gathering. Wondering what recommendations and you might have for areas around south and central Wisconsin and what birds we might see.
All right.
Yeah, good question. I'll give you a couple of things that come out at the top of my head nearby you and also for other people around the state. Mentioned earlier Goose Pond, the Madison Audubon Sanctuary, excellent place for water birds right now. So that's a nice nearby place. Certainly, any of the larger woodlots are places where you can find flocks of the various songbirds that are present. Take a look for the variety of woodpeckers that might be found in the woodlots. Any good woodlot should hold that. For people right now along the eastern side of the state, Lake Michigan is turning up some really good things. There have been quite a few scoters. The three species of the bigger sea ducks are moving, some of them closer to shore. May make themselves a little more visible. A few reports of harlequin ducks, which are western birds that occasionally show up on our Great Lakes. There's one out by Sheboygan that's been seen recently. Milwaukee, some of the lakefront area there have turned up some good birds, including snowy owls. Snowy owls, we've got reports scattered all over the state with, I think, it's 15 or 16 individuals now sighted. For people on the western side of the state, Mississippi is a great place. The ducks should still be gathered up among the shallows. Swans should be staging there. People in the central part of the state, some of the larger marshes right now are hosting big flocks of sandhill cranes as they're staging and forming the big flocks before they move on. So places like, of course, Horicon Marsh, up by Navarino, in central Wisconsin, the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, Sandhill Wildlife Area, in the far northwest, by Grantsburg, the Crex Meadows. These are excellent spots. And for people in the far north woods, watch for the finches. Yeah. We've got some good reports right now of early arrivals of red crossbills. They're coming in, and some red poles as well. So we may have some of the winter finches coming in.
Yeah, and if you've never heard a snowy owl.
Yeah, just a bellowing hoot. We normally don't hear them down here. It's an Arctic breeder. And they can live in the Arctic in the coldest winter as long as there's food. But periodically, their main food, the lemming population, crashes, which forces a lot of birds south. It's always hard to predict what's going to be a big invasion year of snowy owls. Some years we've had so much available food, they don't even bother to leave. But it seems like at least the beginning of a possible good invasion of snowy owls with scattered sightings this early in the year. We'll see what the rest of winter brings.
And at Goose Pond, you're going to be hearing some tundra swans. You know, I love that song, and you'll hear that at Goose Pond, won't you, Bill?
Oh, yes, when they're sitting on the water, you'll hear that soft moaning. Or oftentimes you'll hear it overhead. That's how I picked out the flocks the last 2 days, is I can hear them off in the distance and just scan the sky, and you may see them riding overhead. Or occasionally with a good north wind that continues into the evening, even after sunset, I've stepped out and I can hear them, though I don't see them overhead. And I'm with you. That is one of my favorite calls for fall. You know, I worked at Horicon Marsh, where Canada geese are certainly the noteworthy bird out there. And everybody knows their call. But to me, it's a little bit raucous. That softer moaning of the tundra swan is really a pleasing thing. And it's also one of those last big migrations that we have to wrap up the year.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike in Bear Valley, we turn to you next. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hello. I really enjoyed the sounds of the birds. That was really great. I got a question about raccoons and bird feeders. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at my bird feeder out the kitchen window right now, and after battling raccoons all summer, there's not much left of it. It's tied together with with some baling twine and the wire mesh for the woodpecker suet is all bent up. But it was quite a battle this year, and I was wondering if there are some suggestions you might have how to keep raccoons away from feeders.
Do you have feeder guards on them, like a little cone around the pole?
Well, I've got a milk jug around the pole. It's a shepherd's, you know, pole, a metal.
Right.
But I had to reinforce it with the fence post because they would just actually bend down the whole shepherd's pole.
I've got shepherd's pole as well for some of my smaller feeders.
Yeah.
And I was able to find, to match those, a small predator guard, which is basically like a little cone that clamps onto the post.
Okay.
And I've got raccoons in the neighborhood here. They're always out here. I put out a trail camera recently, and I've had in one single shot three raccoons running together.
Yeah.
So they're out there, but they do not touch my feeders because they don't have access to it.
Yeah.
So I had to actually trim some bushes back away from it because the chipmunks and squirrels were able to launch themselves from there to the feeder. So I made it so they couldn't reach the feeder anymore. And with the predator guard, the larger mammals and even squirrels can't climb up to it. So,
you need
to do that because raccoons, they can not only have a heck of an appetite compared to a flock of birds, but they can be outrightly destructive, which means it starts to become expensive for always buying new feeders.
Yeah.
So best thing to do is, you need to deter them from access to it. As we get a little colder, they'll eventually go into their winter dormancy. But, you've got to make sure that they don't have access to the feeder.
Yep. There you go.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Steve in Boulder Junction, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. This might be, it's not meant to be a silly question, but it may sound that way. With the eagles being so successful and being kind of reintroduced and they're producing so well, is there a possibility that sometime in the future, be it 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, that they would become so numerous that they'd become pests like English sparrows are now?
No.
Well, that's a good question. We certainly have seen that with cormorants, a bird that was on the endangered list in the 70s and early 80s and now has recovered so well because of the lack of pesticides in the environment. They're becoming a bit of a conflict with the commercial fishermen on the Great Lakes. So here's, you've got a bird that is going after the same food source that some of us are after. For eagles, I don't know, as something that is an opportunist fisher and will also go after carrion, so they will occasionally go after, say, roadkill deer, especially in late fall and wintertime when other food's less available and as the lakes freeze over. I don't see that as much of a conflict as far as their food selection for what we ourselves are looking for. So I really don't think that their habits would lend themselves to a lot of conflict. Probably the main thing would be they are opportunists, and occasionally they may take small mammals, which I suppose on occasion could even include a pet. I did have someone send me a video of an eagle wrestling with a small deer fawn this summer. I think what made it outstanding is that it's not a normal food for them. So as a predatory bird, there may be a chance for a rare conflict out there. But overall, I really don't see that. I think it's a majestic bird, and I don't see it coming into conflict with what we're doing.
Yeah, someone posted, actually the woman who shot the video called the show and posted the video of that eagle drowning that little fawn.
Yeah, that was pretty dramatic. It was quite a long battle, too. And I think that's what made it so outstanding, that first of all, it was a pretty big food source for it. It was, I guess we could say, a bit of a gory battle to take it down. And it was so exceptional for what an eagle normally goes after.
Yeah, yeah.
One other unrelated question?
Sure.
Yes, please.
While I was waiting to get on, you were talking about birds staging in a marsh and getting ready to leave. Who makes the decision when they leave? Is there some sort of a bird leader that takes off one morning and everyone follows, or is there a group of leaders, or do they communicate with each other somehow that today is the day?
Yeah, great question. Well, first of all, whether it's cranes or Canada geese, birds that tend to migrate in large flocks, as far as a leader, I consider that to be a myth, because after all the adults, and for these bigger birds, it takes several years before they reach adulthood, they've migrated several years, and they could all lead the flock, so to speak.
And they do lead the flock. They take turns, don't they?
Well, basically what you have is the adults will lead their young, and then others will join the flock. So those V formations are typical for larger birds, and this is simply because it reduces the wind resistance. But there is a myth that the leader of the flock is the oldest, wisest, strongest, who gets out in front and takes everybody on their way. Well, all the other parents and older birds in the flock all know the way as well as that one out there. My feeling has always been, when I've watched Canada geese in a V, is it isn't one bird that takes that charge and everybody else falls in line. It just takes off, and because of wind resistance and that V formation, everybody else falls behind it. It's just leading its own family, and next thing you know, it's out in front of the whole flock. But you will see, as they get buffeted by wind, and no doubt the lead bird does have a little more work because nobody else is breaking that wind for them, they will fall back and they will move around a little bit. It isn't as, say, the human character of, you know, I will now lead the entire flock, and, you know, as I get tired, I'll call someone up to the front to take a turn. So I think that, you know, that anthropomorphism gets maybe a little bit reading too much into what's going on in the behavior of the birds. But, yes, they do call to themselves, and in among themselves there is that kind of cacophony that you're going to hear, that rising of voices and that excitement, and that flock is going to decide it's time to go. They do actually have flight calls that they'll give, and when some of them go, I guess the rest of them figure this is the day. You're right. Let's do it.
Oh, boy. Connie in Portage, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, Larry. I was listening to an Atlantic call then talking about just seeing feathers on the ground.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, in my backyard, this is what I saw with my own eyes. I couldn't believe it. A kestrel. I was feeding in the wintertime. There were probably 40 doves. And it swooped down, took one of my doves, and it seemed like just within seconds, it had devoured, and I ran out there, and all that was left was some feathers.
That's actually quite pretty. Quite the backyard drama. Kestrels, of course, are a falcon, a bird of prey. Their main food is the small rodents, and in summertime, they switch over to the large insects like grasshoppers and crickets even, which is an abundant food source. Mourning dove is a pretty big prey item for a small bird like that to handle, but as you've obviously seen, when they get desperate or when the opportunity presents itself, they will give it a shot and occasionally are successful. But again, like the deer going or eagle going after a deer fawn, this is kind of exceptional, and it's certainly the larger end of what a bird like that can handle.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks a lot for calling.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Kate, what's on your mind from Menasha?
Okay, I know you don't have a lot of time, so I'll try to be quick. I've devised a system for suspending a bird feeder that is squirrel-proof and varmint-proof. You do need a large tree with an overhanging branch, so that's kind of hard to arrange, but you suspend your bird feeder with a coated cable from a large overhanging branch. It has to be, you know, what, more than 15 feet from the branch, and more than 10 feet from the ground, but I have been using that, and nobody gets to it but the birds.
Well, you've been very successful then. That's one of the frustrations of feeding birds is squirrels. They are extremely clever, and they are persistent. My general feeling has been that there is no such thing as a squirrel-proof feeder. There are more squirrel-resistant feeders than others, but I've always felt that by the time you have something that is 100% squirrel-proof, it's probably bird-proof, too. they can be a challenge, and there are ways, as you mentioned, suspending the feeders and getting away from the trees that make it more difficult for the squirrels, but it can be a frustration. And as the fellow with his raccoon, same thing. A squirrel can get in there and eat an awful lot of food compared to a couple of birds.
Absolutely.
So it can get expensive and can get challenging. But it sounds like you've solved your local problem.
Thank you so much for calling. And, Bill, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.
Look forward to your next visit. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. Well, tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about home improvement. Our guests will take your questions on how to prepare your home for that cold winter. So I hope you can stay warm and comfortable. Hope you can join us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network, so please stay with us.